Greetings and welcome. My name is Mary Black Juntinen. I'm the music librarian responsible for, say 100,000 scores and 50,000 books and 17,000 CDs and a bunch of videos and records and so forth. So if you ever have any questions about music, I do hope you'll come and look me up because probably I can help you. I don't guarantee I can find everything, but you know. Majority of things. And we do have a large collection that's open to everyone, and so I would encourage you to come. And in fact, I just looked up, as far as Greece is concerned, we have 4 complete CDs, we have some excerpts, we have the libretto, and we have the vocal score. So you're all set to go listen and sing and be happy. Actually, I don't know Greece. I know the more classic musicals, and I guess I better go listen to Greece. It's my pleasure to introduce Marcy Ray. She's an assistant professor of musicology at the MSU College of Music. And this year, she's a Lilly Teaching Fellow. She holds degrees from the University of Texas, a Bachelor's of Music in Vocal Performance, and from the University of California, Los Angeles, where she was a Chancellor's Fellow and acquired her MA and PhD. She has presented her research in numerous national and international conferences. Her recently completed book manuscript titled The Politics of Love in French Baroque Spectacles illustrates how male composers and librettists transformed and diminished early feminist literary characters when they adapted them for the stage. A portion of this research has been published in the journal Musica on Perspectiva in 2013 and the essay collection called The Libretto as Enlightenment Text in 2015. Her work on Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady has just come out in the journal American Music in 2014. And before I have Marcy come up, I would say we have some bottled water back there. You're welcome to help yourself. If we need more, let me know. And there's receptacles for recycling when you're done. And so please welcome Marcy Ray.
I want to thank all of you for being here. I know that there are many other music things happening this evening, and so you had your choice of options, and so I appreciate you being here. I also know the choice was to stay home and drink beer and watch TV. So I do appreciate you coming here at this time of year, especially at the end of the semester, since there are so many students here, that I know you would probably prefer to do something else. But I am glad that you're here. And I also want to thank Trevor for helping me with the video examples, and also Aaron, because I cornered him today. And I was like, young person, technology, help me. Because I did a Prezi presentation for the first time for this, because PowerPoint wouldn't host all my, it wouldn't contain all my files. So this is new for me. 2 years ago, Harlan Jennings invited me to give a talk in this series, and it gave me an opportunity to begin work on my second book manuscript, which is going to be on the makeover film musicals. And for that talk in 2013, I presented an essay on the 1964 film adaptation of Alan J. Lerner and Friedrich Lowe's My Fair Lady. In it, I argued that it was as much an adaptation of Ovid's Pygmalion as it was of his Echo and Narcissus. In particular, the protagonist, Professor Henry Higgins, is too in love with himself to develop romantic feelings for his pupil, Eliza Doolittle. As it turns out, what I will argue in this paper is not altogether different. This evening, I'd like to turn to what will become my second chapter, focusing on Jim Jacob and Warren Casey's 1971 musical Grease, adapted for film in 1978. All right. So initially, I intended to talk about the transformation of the heroine, Sandy, from wholesome young woman to the leather-clad vixen she becomes in the final scene. The radical metamorphosis at the end of the film provides a troubling message for women. It suggests to get the guy, it's okay to change what you look like, and by extension, who you are. The fact that this musical also deals with teen pregnancy and gang violence, and yet is often staged in high school music programs, including our very own East Lansing last year, might give us pause. However, I think Greece demonstrates a much larger makeover for men and masculinity. In fact, I am tempted to call this a masculine romance. That is, it seems to wax nostalgic about a kind of rebel masculinity purported to have existed in the simpler times of the 1950s. Indeed, for some, mid-century would, in hindsight, seem much clearer in terms of gender roles, since it was an era before the civil rights movement, second wave feminism, and gay liberation. Looking back from the vantage point of the late 1970s, it could appear that the 1950s was a decade when men and women were more secure in their roles in the family economy. But Greece is less invested in defining sex roles than it is in shoring up the authority of a particular masculine ideal. I argue that this film longs for a lost past emblematized in 1950s male rebellion and rock and roll. I show that Greece, through the characters, plot, and music, contributed to a larger cultural endeavor to remasculinize America. In this case, particularly for audiences who felt threatened by the rise of disco and, moreover, the new expressions of masculinity associated with it. This film responds to what amounted to a moral panic over the decline of hegemonic white, middle-class, heterosexual masculinity, which music critics express through their anxiety about changing musical tastes. Okay. At the end of the 1970s, music critics lamented the death of rock music. But as it often turns out, musical criticism is often largely a veil for social criticism. Social critics and music critics alike were singing a requiem for the loss of white hegemonic male ideals. At the end of the 1970s, disco had become a $4 billion a year industry, and music reviewers began to suggest that disco was taking over, implying that the genre was usurping rock's formerly central position. Surprisingly, race was largely erased in this discourse. Instead, critics focused on sexuality and, oddly, class. Discos had become associated with gay men and with a sophisticated set because club owners had very strict dress codes. Rock fans began to charge disco with elitism, claiming that it was out of touch with mainstream American values. Mainly, music critics disguised their homophobia and class anxiety in a discussion of aesthetics. Robert Vare, a writer for the New York Times, for instance, lamented, "The disco decade," "the disco decade is one of glitter and gloss without substance, subtlety, or more than surface sexuality. The disco decade is the era when intimacy and close personal connections are to be avoided, even within the self. In the 1960s, of course, Americans would have given anything for something as mindless and impersonal as a disco, an escape hatch from the social responsibilities, from the shouting and the shoving in the streets. How we have found the answer. All we have to do is blow dry our protein-enriched hair, anoint ourselves with musk oil, snort another line of cocaine, and turn up the volume. After the lofty expectations, passions, and disappointments of the 1960s, we have the passive resignation and glitzy paroxysms of the disco 1970s. After the poetry of the Beatles comes the monotonous bass pedal bombardment of Donna Summer." Vare empties disco of its political potential, declaring that it's simply a superficial music, an escape hatch from the subtext is the civil rights movement, Stonewall, and feminist consciousness raising. Furthermore, he ignores the fact that disco was not, in fact, impersonal music, but became an emerging symbol for community and coherence for gay men in particular. But discotheques were also safe spaces for blacks and Latinos. Critics had reason to fear disco and the communities it fostered. Between the summers of 1975 and 1977, over 12,000 discos opened across the United States. All of this panic culminated in an event a year after Grease's movie release. On Thursday, July 12, 1979, 70,000 people crowded into Comiskey Park in Chicago for a doubleheader between the Chicago White Sox and the Detroit Tigers. Many of the spectators, however, were not there to see the games. Instead, they hope to see the destruction of thousands of disco records during the intermission between the baseball games. It was billed as Disco Demolition Night, and it was organized by Chicago radio disc jockey named Steve Dahl in collaboration with Mike Veek, the promotion manager for the White Sox. Weeks before the game, Dahl invited his listeners to collect the disco records that they would like to see destroyed during the game. And to motivate his listeners, those who brought records would be charged a quarter of the price of admission to the baseball game. About 10,000 people turned in records as they entered the stadium. Inside the stadium, people held up banners with slogans like, "Disco sucks." And others shouted anti-disco chants. Even before the intermission, the crowd had become rowdy, throwing records even at some of the players. By 8:40 p.m., Dahl, dressed in fatigues and an army helmet accompanied by a blonde model, drove into the field in a military-style Jeep. 50,000 disco records were placed in the center of the field, and eventually a fireworks bomb destroyed the music. Afterwards, the crowd rushed the field and started a riot. But within 30 minutes, the police department's tactical force was summoned to restore peace. And although it didn't take very long for the police to empty the field, the umpire declared the area unplayable. What's important about this event from a musicological perspective is the condemnation against a particular kind of music and its role in a larger anti-disco backlash. Historian Julian Frank has observed that this was a movement directed at music as well as the people associated with it. Discophobia constructed disco as gay and rock as straight. And it was a design articulated largely by white middle-class music critics. To understand rock's association with whiteness and heterosexual masculinity, we need to return to the 1950s. In this era of late middle capitalism, social critics began to notice the tension between individual male autonomy and bureaucratic modernity. A number of texts attest to the fact that men were beginning to feel trapped by managerial capitalism and its dehumanizing conformity. Ooh, that's not it. Here we go, the lonely crowd. The shrinking man. The man in the gray flannel suit. They needed someone to blame. So many took up the age-old target, women. Philip Wiley, in his book Generation of Vipers from 1942, blames mothers, in particular, for everything from gay sons and feminist daughters to fascism. This renewed fear of women only solidified by women's growing awareness of their potentials in the workforce during World War II merged with the perceived feminizing effect of the modern workplace. As Sarah Evans has put it in gendered terms, bureaucratic values emphasized female traits of cooperation, passivity, security. Getting along and being well-liked became new life goals. Yet the older definitions of masculinity remained. And few could recognize the contradictory fact that what one part of their consciousness valued, another part judged unmanly. To combat submission and emasculation in the 1950s, the nonconformist emerged as a new hero. To thwart men's slow death through conformity, white youth mapped out a rebel ideal, one that combined imagery of delinquent youth with the fiction of African-American insurgents. In his 1957 essay, The White Negro, a very weird essay, novelist Norman Mailer argued that white men should appropriate what was obviously a romanticized notion of the African-American man, who was, and I quote, "male urban outlaw, living on the edge, searching out sex, using marijuana, appreciating jazz, finding momentary truth in the body." Rock icons provide some of the most important elements of this kind of racial discourse. To shore up a deviant masculinity, constructions of rock deployed early 20th century American racial mythology, which pitted the pure, domesticated white woman against what was constructed as the African-American beast on the other end. This kind of racial ideology is made clear in what we saw here before, D.W. Griffith's 1915 film, The Birth of a Nation, in which the Ku Klux Klan comes racing heroically to the aid of white women besieged by menacing African-American men, as well as, unfortunately, King Kong. But unlike Birth of a Nation, rock music positioned itself against women because they symbolized the faceless and emasculating industrialized social order. In a very complicated maneuver, white rock musicians pitted themselves against women while standing in for the visually absent, mythic black man whose music they performed. A few examples come to mind.
So we've got our novels and our rebel.
Okay, so rock music icons that epitomize this kind of rebel masculinity in the 1950s, of course, Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins. It is easy to see that it is these images that Greece idealizes at the end of the 70s. Unsurprisingly, straight white American men may have felt the sands shifting beneath them in the late 1970s. Traditional masculinity had been besieged from all sides for two decades already, threatened by the civil rights movement, second wave feminism, and gay liberation. Even in the late 1950s, eminent historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. observed a crisis of masculinity. What has happened to the American male? For a long time, he seemed utterly confident in his manhood, sure of his masculine role in society, easy and definite in his sense of sexual identity. Today, men are more and more conscious of maleness, not as a fact, but as a problem. The ways by which American men affirm their masculinity are uncertain and obscure. There are multiplying signs, indeed, that something has gone badly wrong with the American male's conception of himself. In the 1960s, these concerns would only escalate. After Betty Friedan exposed the myth of the ideal woman in her 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique, men, too, began to question their roles as breadwinners and hard-hearted heroes, after which the floodgates were opened. Black men questioned their exclusion from American manhood, as did gay men and even middle-class white men. While with this came great anxiety, as expressed in the song, Are You a Boy or Are You a Girl?, a 1965 hit from the group The Barbarians. Furthermore, even the soldier, the quintessentially masculine role, came under fire during Vietnam. Thus, by the 1970s, some cultural critics believed that conventional masculinity was in peril. Some men enthusiastically embraced the critique of sex roles and, following women's examples, created what became a men's liberation movement. As a response to second wave feminism, men organized consciousness raising groups, workshops, and newsletters. The Berkeley Men's Center manifesto put it like this: "We no longer want to strain and compete to live up to an impossible, oppressive masculine image. Strong, silent, cool, handsome, unemotional, successful, master of women, leader of men, wealthy, brilliant, athletic, heavy." But it was a tricky project. Men's liberationists need to walk the fine line between critiquing the cost of ideal masculinity to their physical and emotional health while acknowledging their institutional power that granted them numerous privileges. Warren Farrell's book, The Liberated Man, is a case in point. He argued that in some ways, men were more constricted than women. He writes, "The counterpart of the media's household mother, wife, maid, mistress is the infallibly successful, accomplished, virile male. Men may even be more restricted in their identity as human beings. Men can climb to the top of a wider range of occupations to fulfill their image, but they are even more restricted than women and the contempt they receive should they deviate into a feminine role or fail the masculine one. Women can smoke a Marlboro, but no man dares smoke an Eve. Women can wear pantsuits, yet no American male wears a dress."
Pharaoh manages to explain the cost of masculinity here very well, but he ignores the unearned privileges men enjoy simply by being white, straight, and male. Despite these tensions in his work, he initiated a number of practical dialogues when he became one of the first male members of the National Organization of Women and served on its task force on the masculine mystique. Unfortunately, under the strain of this fragile balance, the men's movement split into two groups, one that espoused feminism and its critique of gender inequities, and those that developed men's rights activism, often from an anti-feminist perspective. Herb Goldberg's 1976, The Hazards of Being Male, Surviving the Myth of Masculine Privilege, is an early example of the latter discourse. In terms of its basic principles, it's not too different from the work of Farrell, but its emphasis is on men rather than the disparities of power between men and women. More than Farrell, however, Goldberg argued that men were in fact worse off than women, even going so far as to assert that he lived in a largely matriarchal society. Even Farrell apparently was persuaded. In 1993, he published his Myth of Male Power. So, how does Greece, like late 70s men's rights activists, attempt to reestablish an older, idealized masculinity in the wake of changing male identities? A crucial juxtaposition of scenes epitomizes this quest. The film opens with Sandy and Danny enjoying a romantic day at the beach. Summer days are fading fast, and they think their brief romance must come to an end.
Life, and now I have to go away. It isn't fair. Danny, don't spoil it.
It's not spoiling it, Sandy. It's only making it better.
Danny, is this the end?
Of course not. It's only the beginning.
Family, originally from Australia, decides fortuitously to stay in America, and she enrolls in the same high school as Danny. But it's not until the school's first pep rally that the couple realizes that they are going to the same school. What might have been an ecstatic reunion turns sour when Danny realizes, in front of his buddies, that he shouldn't be so excited about a girl.
For you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sandy!
Danny?
What are you doing here? I thought you were going back to Australia.
We had a change of plans.
Well, that's cool, baby. I mean, you know how it is, rocking and rolling and whatnot.
Danny?
That's my name. Don't wear it out.
What's the matter with you?
What's the matter with me, baby? What's the matter with you?
Yeah. What happened to the Danny Zuko I met at the beach?
Well, I do not know. I mean, maybe there's two of us, right? Why don't you take out a missing persons ad or try the yellow pages? I don't know.
You're a fake and a phony, and I wish I'd never laid eyes on you.
Whoa.
Whoa.
I wonder if she carries silver bullets.
Yeah.
Whoa. So she laid her eyes on you, eh, Zuko?
Hey, I bet that's not all she's laid on him.
You're right. Hey, Zuko, got that car, remember?
Spectators have no reason yet to be worried. So far, it follows the traditional romantic comedy plot. Boy and girl meet, but some obstacle, a father or romantic rival, prevents them from staying together. Here, it's Danny's tough guy reputation. Nevertheless, audiences might imagine at this point that the rest of the show will be about how the hero renegotiates his identity to accommodate romantic love. This is not what happens. Instead, the authors construct Sandy as a dangerous threat to the hero's identity, while lionizing Danny's ability to resist conformity. To save the love plot, Sandy, in a last-ditch effort to win Danny over, transforms herself to become more like him. It is easy to see how Danny Zuko reinvents the 1950s rebel. He runs with the greasers called the T-Birds, and much of the film is spent not on his anticipated transformation, but on shoring up his tough guy reputation. Two aspects of his character provide insight. First, in an attempt to win Sandy back, particularly from her new athlete boyfriend, Danny decides to try out for high school sports teams. Yet, as the coach quickly finds out, the protagonist is not suited for team sports. The hero is too likely to resort to fisticuffs if things do not go his way. He won't be constrained by the conformity required even in team sports.
I think you're gonna like baseball. It's not that much of a contact sport. Now get in there and let's see what you can do, all right? Throw the ball. Come on, let's play.
Hey, where would you like
Come on,
it?
Let's get it up.
Right down the
Come
pipe.
On, man, let's pitch this guy out
let's
here.
Go. Hey,
oh, man, this boy can't even bat. Can't even hold a ball.
Is that right?
See, I told you, he doesn't even swing. What kind of ball player are you? Come on, put it in here, pitcher.
Is that right?
Come on, a little pepper, a little fire. Come on, a little fire in there. Come on, come on. Let's see you hit it. Put it in, put it in, put it in.
Foul ball.
Easy, yeah, easy,
come
easy,
on,
easy,
come
easy,
on.
Easy. Put the bat down. Put the bat down.
Danny finally decides to run track, but also, more importantly, will race the T-Birds' rival gang at the climax of the film. There, his individual masculine aggression is an ingredient for success. The rebel image here is bolstered by music that is distinctly reminiscent of 1950s rock, particularly that of Jerry Lee Lewis, but with the wailing of the electric guitar in the background.
You ain't gonna see me for death, Zuko.
We'll be right back.
Furthermore, Danny's masculinity is fashioned against Sandy's embodiment of a threatening femininity. Her country-inflected song, Hopelessly Devoted to You, offers the kind of stranglehold that he must reject. Indeed, several times she sings about how she will hold on to the end because she's got nothing else to do. It isn't this Sandy that will win her man. She's too buttoned up, literally, here, actually.
And she's really needy.
The imagery at the end of this clip goes a long way to proving my argument that this is a narcissist's tale. As she gazes into the pool, it is not her image reflected in the water, but Danny's.
Guess mine is not the first heartbroken. My eyes are not the first to cry. I'm not the first to know. There's just no getting over you.
Sandy's song does two things, at least two things. It reinforces the notion of the pure white woman, subservient to the white man, a nostalgic fantasy linked to the 1950s. But it simultaneously threatens his dominance with its potentially emasculating siren call. This was, in fact, added for the film because in her contract, she got to have a solo and they hadn't written it. So she got this and it became very, very popular. It lost an Oscar to another more popular song. I can't remember at the moment, but it was up for an Oscar. The tension between these two images of women had been circulating for decades. Publications for the last 30 years, from the Generation of Vipers to Playboy, had been making distinctions between women who emasculated men, wives, and women who didn't, young, sexually adventurous women who weren't in it for the long haul. The flight from commitment echoed in several corners. In 1967, the Mutants Commune in California issued a manifesto that read, "The 1919-007 Betty Crocker Miss Clairol Family Institution is a death form. Marriage, responsibility for children, alimony are death." At the other end of the spectrum, Charles Reich, a professor at Yale, declared in his 1970 The Greening of America that, quote, "marriage meant staying permanently in my present job, it meant children, a concept I was utterly unprepared for, it meant being adult, which meant no more hope of excitement, no more fun, a sudden and final leap into middle age. It would have been like a prison sentence." In the end, Danny cannot give in to the lure of bourgeois conformity. It would only confirm contemporary men's fears about their own emasculation. Instead, Sandy must change so that Danny can fall in love with his own image. Some might argue that the hero did become an athlete, lettering in track to appeal to Sandy, but the final scene makes clear that this was an entirely superficial maneuver. As soon as he sees Sandy's transformation, he quickly discards his letterman sweater. At the end of the following clip, the camera shows Danny hitting the carnival game known as the High Striker. When the puck hits the bell, the audience has been encouraged to believe that Danny maintains his masculinity, even in his renewed relationship with the heroine.
It is Zuko!
You gotta be kidding me! Halloween?
Where did you swipe this letterman sweater, huh?
My tools were out stealing hubcaps. I lettered in track. How do you like that? I can't believe it. Danny Zuko turned jock?
That's right, it is. What are you doing, deserting us?
Well, you guys can't follow leader all your lives, can you? Oh, come on, guys. You know you mean a lot to me. It's just that Sandy does too, and I'm gonna do anything I can to get her, that's it.
Electrifying.
finally, I'd like to use John Travolta as a case study in late 70s masculinity. His roles in the last few years of the decade indicate the proliferation of masculine heroes. He starred first in Saturday Night Fever, a story about a young working class kid who finds success at the local disco. Then he starred in Grease, followed by Urban Cowboy. Despite playing some of the most iconic stereotypes of ideal masculinity as the rebel and the cowboy, Travolta would never quite lose his association with disco. Henry Allen dished up the following review for the Washington Post in 1978. Women seem to be particularly astonished or delighted or intrigued by a scene in Saturday Night Fever in which John Travolta gets dressed to go out dancing. It took me a while to figure out why. There was John Travolta with that sweet, simple dignity of a 20-year-old preening, with absolutely no sense of sin, with no fears of being feminine, and none of the buffoonery that tends to accompany portrayals of the working class in American movies or TV shows. In other words, Travolta was being sinful, feminine, working class, and unashamed. With this one movie, the actor became associated with gay culture, and it continues to follow him to this day, even though his next two films attempted to shore up a much more traditional masculine sensibility. Yet, as late as September of last year, according to the Huffington Post, Travolta is still responding to gay rumors. Here's Urban Cowboy. To conclude, I think analyzing Grease in terms of masculinity has a lot more to offer us than thinking about Sandy's metamorphosis. Sure, it might speak to a kind of sexual liberation for women, but only in the most limiting ways, since the heroine's newly discovered sexuality will be contained in what we can only imagine will be a monogamous relationship with the hero. Instead, thinking about Grease as part of a broader cultural movement to retrench masculinity in older iconic stereotypes reveals much more about gender relations at the end of the 70s. Furthermore, looking at John Travolta's roles in this period can give us a sense of why some men might have felt the ground shifting beneath them. Which role would be considered emblematically masculine? The 50s rebel, the cowboy, or the working class youth who dances his troubles away? The gay rumors have followed Travolta from the 70s alerts us to the fact that the dominant masculine ideal still has a long way to go before it reaches the ambitions first expressed in the male feminist movement at the beginning of the 1970s. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions, and I see that there's one right over there.
So this is a comment, and there might be a question in here. I'm not quite sure yet.
Fabulous.
Okay, so I think so you talked about how a lot of this was driven, this new masculinity, in a sense, was driven by the women's movement and in response to the Stonewall riots. And I think it's really interesting how after the Stonewall riots within the gay community, you start to see the allowance of a new kind of a new gay identity.
Yes.
Which is also this new masculinity that is being constructed in response to their new liberation movement, in a sense.
Right.
And so it's hard for me to wrap my head around that. And I was wondering if you might be able to add some lucidity.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? I mean, dominant masculinity can only really fight against a coherent threat, really. So once, young black men have a coherent identity, once femininity has cohered into this force that actually, is getting legislation passed, and once gay men have a coherent enough identity to fight against, then that's where the hegemonic male identity has something to kind of push up against. It's hard to tell kind of what's happening there because they were responding to a number of different forces. Partly the association with like emasculation or effeminacy, but also a new liberated femininity. So it's hard to tell like what exactly, but it's clear that it's sort of the Raymond Williams. It has to sort of absorb and deflect these new things. And in coming to terms with a masculinity that's being besieged on all sides, it
resorts to older models. So I think maybe because there's like this consolidation of a new public gay male identity, then this is why I think in the late 1970s we get this collision between disco and rock. Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
Well, just a comment. I remember the 1950s very clearly, and it was exactly as you presented it. Everybody, all the families on my block had a father who had a job, and the women stayed home. And occasionally they would give coffees for each other or tea parties, but they kept house and looked after the offspring. And I remember when my mother went to work for the first time in 1964, my dad didn't like it. He didn't want her to work in the library.
A dangerous place.
Full of ideas.
Indeed.
No, that reflected badly on him.
Right.
And was a challenge to his masculinity. And of course, he was part of that generation that had defeated the Axis powers and to come back home victorious and wanted everything to go back to just the way it had been before World War II.
Yes, but from the perspective of the 1970s, I mean, the 1950s looked a lot rosier than it actually was. I mean, we've got these housewives who were taking speed and were drinking heavily throughout the day because they were so bored, right? And I mean, I didn't talk about this in context of Greece, but it's also, I mean, it's the 1950s and it's all white people here, because it imagines, you know, the non-integrated past. And so I think there's probably some race troubles here, too.
Well, sure. I was in Topeka, Kansas. Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. I remember when that came down.
Yes.
I was right there.
Yeah, so when in 1971, they were, busing black children to white schools, and this was written in 1971, and it's probably not too much of a coincidence that it's an imagining a kind of ideal past. Yeah. Questions, comments, other things? Critiques? It's a new project for me, so I'm happy to, you know, entertain whatever holes you think are there. Yes, Sarah.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, sort of,
can you talk a little bit about images of masculinity in musicals that are being written today? Like, how do they compare to this? Like, are they similar? Are they different? Like, how is this playing out now?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not a musical scholar. I just finished a book on Baroque opera, so this is new territory. So I can't really speak to all like masculinities in musicals today, but there are some other things that I want to look at. So I know Phantom of the Opera was just here, right? And Stalker.
yes.
Yeah.
Said that over and over.
Yeah. I mean, and we all love it. We're like, oh, it's so great, you know. And but I'm sorry, but like Super Stalker, sketchiness. So I mean, I think in different eras, when we have like different kinds of collisions between the genders, we're going to see different things. So in the 1950s, musicals were dominated by the love plot and men and women getting together and marrying in the end. What's interesting about the 1960s is that the musicals change and we feature a lot of single women who don't get together with men at the end. Okay, so we have more of that, Sweet Charity, Hello Dolly, so forth. And then the 70s goes a number of different directions. So I haven't quite explored the 80s, but it's clear that masculinity retrenches and becomes pretty conservative. So we're gonna, I expect to see when I look at more of those that I'll see that. But then past that point, I mean, now we have, gay characters and so forth, so we might have some different kinds of romances. But I still think, in general, musicals tends to be a fairly conservative form. and relies heavily on the love plot.
Thanks for that. I found quite a bit of it very interesting. I had a slightly different take, however, from the clips that you chose.
Yeah.
And some of the approaches. My own memory of the kind of representation that most of us saw, sadly, I also remember the 50s, although the tail end, I wish I didn't. Certainly through the 60s and through the mid-70s, all the representation of white males, and of course, always exclusively white males, was very much over the top, stereotypically masculine, or as they wanted to see themselves. The two shows far and away that were the most popular were things like The Virginian or Gunsmoke and that sort of thing.
Right.
And all this sort of imagination where the right. men were probably more likely in love with their horse than they were with the right. female interest. I found compelling, however, the sort of subtext that you brought out about the narcissism that we see throughout that. In fact, the Travolta character is actually depicted more as something of a buffoon. His problem is that he's more worried about how he acts with the buddies that he hangs around. And I think that's actually brought up purposefully in that very last number, where he actually acts like a clown. I mean, he's very unmasculine in that last number. Over the top, so, whereas she's quite steady.
Right.
In both her personifications, she's a very solid, steady character. So in some ways, it's a very much feminist text. So if the male is being represented as a sort of recapturing masculinity, it's done in a very sort of over-the-top caricature way. And I wonder if that's purposeful, too.
So, oh, yeah.
So the narcissism element is there. It is a characterized representation of what masculinity ought to be, because he certainly doesn't fit that role.
Right.
Interestingly enough, as well, I mean, if we were to go back, at the time, the clueless heterosexual white male probably didn't understand that very masculine characters like a Marlon Brando or a Montgomery Clift were in fact gay, where I imagine that gay men understood that implicitly.
Right.
But again, very interesting that those actors were chosen to represent those roles. So there's a number of layers.
Yes.
It comes back to all the narcissism. It's how the men are seeing themselves reflected.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, absolutely. I think certain audiences could see these portrayals as ironic. And sort of from a critical distance. But then, you know, there's always the possibility with a lot of things, especially with irony, that people aren't seeing the irony there, that it's, that, you know, this is sort of the danger of that critical lens, is that not everybody sees it, and so then we get this, because we do see a retrenching in the 80s of conservative masculine ideals. So even if, you know, I mean, certainly John Travolta's career is a case in point because, you know, he goes on to play a cross-dressed figure in Hair. What's that?
In Hairspray.
Yeah, in Hairspray. Yeah, Hairspray. Sorry, not Hair. And so clearly he's comfortable enough. But what's interesting about something like that is that playing cross-dressed characters doesn't seem to have any effect on whether or not the actor himself is portrayed as gay. So we have several male figures who dress up as women in movies, but then there's no, we don't question their identity, but somehow John Travolta, by playing a character who likes disco, that was enough to question his masculinity from this point forward. So it's tough to say whether or not, you know, some of these roles were an attempt to, like, reimagine masculinity, but for him, it seems like not to have been a personal quest at all. So it's an interesting point, I think, to think about the irony there and which audiences might have perceived that. Other things? Yeah.
A minor point, very minor point, because I happen to be quite attached to the theme song for this musical.
Yeah.
Which was written by the Bee Gees.
Yes, it was.
And sung by Frankie Valli.
Yes, it was.
Can you contextualize that?
Yeah, so actually the opening, after the credits, after we get this romantic scene, then we get disco. We actually get disco. And I think, in fact, that frames, for me, it frames how we're supposed to see this. We're supposed to kind of, it's supposed to bring up this juxtaposition between rock and roll and disco. And so I haven't quite developed that enough yet, but I do feel like it's meant to kind of give us some critical distance to the 1950s and say, this is where we are, and people loved the theme song, but actually the director himself didn't want it. He felt that this is inappropriate for a film about the 1950s. And I don't know whether or not it was actually just his personal feeling because it was the 1950s, a film about the 1950s, or whether or not it was a personal opinion against disco, because certainly that was floating around as well. And the rock criticism, at least, suggests that rock critics were very, very anxious about disco and really pitted themselves and rock music as distinctly white, distinctly male, distinctly heterosexual. And so this blending in this film of disco and having that frame it, I think, is something that I'm going to think more about, but also that might ask us to think about that juxtaposition, because it's at the very beginning. All right, well, I know I've kept you long enough on a Wednesday evening at the end of the semester, and I thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. And if you have other questions, feel free to come up, and I'd be happy to talk to you.